Good evening. This is Steve Anderson filling in for Eva Herr and Infinite Consciousness. We have a special guest tonight, Mark Goldies. Mark, you there?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I've been looking at your webpage and find it fascinating. Why don't you just give me a brief introduction about who you are, and then we'll talk about what you're up to.
Well, I started out to be an electrical engineer and found that I was bored with electrical engineering, went on to study other things. But in the early 70s, when we had the first oil crunch, I looked back on my engineering days and said, you know, there must be something we could do to run our cars that would not require oil. And so I began a research institute called ESOP that still exists, ESOP like the fables. And the institute first spun off a commercial firm called Sunwind Limited. Sunwind was a corporation here in California that created, with a professor of aeronautical engineering in Michigan, a vehicle called the Windmobile, which could go down the freeway powered by the wind, made the cover of Popular Science way back in November of 1976, and essentially showed that you could actually have a vehicle go down the freeway powered by wind energy, which I think everybody in science at that time would have said, well, that's not possible. And this was an electric vehicle that had a backup electrical system that could take it to 42 miles an hour maximum. The story is on our website.
Mm-hmm.
But with wind energy, it could easily go 65, which it did many times, and it was on the freeways of Michigan. So that's our first experience with alternative energy.
And of course, not much happened with that because gas was not $4 a gallon.
Well, and also because we found that people who were old enough to finance that as a production item would take one look at this vehicle that looked more like a airplane, like a jet airplane, than it did a car.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say, you'd never get me into anything like that Windmobile. But young people loved it, and that we never were able to put it into production because we couldn't finance it. So that company wound down and will become a division, ironically, of this company in the future.
Great.
But in 1984, we decided that we might be able to create the energy we need to drive our vehicles in a way that would not make the vehicle look any different than it always has. And that's how we got into magnetics. And the reason that happened is that a scientist, a physicist at Hughes Aircraft, the late Dr. Robert Forward, a rather distinguished physicist, wrote a paper in a refereed physics journal called Physical Review B, in which he suggested we could get our energy from what's known as zero-point energy, which some scientists call space energy and others call the energetic vacuum or the quantum vacuum. But this is energy that's everywhere in the universe. There's an extraordinary amount of it. It's so dense that Feynman, Richard Feynman, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics, once told a class that if you could liberate all of the zero-point energy in a seemingly empty coffee cup, you could evaporate the oceans of the Earth.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So there's plenty of this energy. And in March of 2004, Aviation Week, March 1st, of that year, ran an article in which they pointed out that zero-point energy was no longer fringe science. Big aerospace companies, including BAE, the European or the English parallel to Boeing, admitted openly that they were working on Mach 4 fighter aircraft that would be powered by zero-point energy and transport aircraft of remarkably high speed, far greater than even supersonic airliners. And in that article, they interviewed Harold Puthoff, a very well-known physicist in this field, and someone asked him, well, if the planet ran on this, wouldn't we run out of it? And he said, well, it would be a little bit like dipping a thimble into the ocean.
Hmm.
So we're looking at a huge reservoir of energy everywhere in the universe that has never been commercialized. And here we've been using up the Earth's fossil resources, the resources that are not only running out, but they now threaten life on this planet, because of a very little-known emergency. Everyone's heard about global warming, and global warming is a problem. And the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a problem, although there are scientists that disagree. We find most of them, of course, are being provided with funds by oil companies. But there's a very much more basic problem called the methane hydrates. Methane is released as a ice form from melting permafrost. And if you were to ignite methane hydrate, which is a form of ice, it will burn. It's released in huge quantities when the permafrost melts.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, a couple of times in human history, once 253 million years ago and once 55 million years ago, almost all life on planet Earth was eliminated by this release of methane, in those days from thousands of volcanoes that were warming the atmosphere sufficiently so that this terrible burping of this methane hydrate caused Earth to go down to single-celled creatures. And for 100,000 years, it did not recover. And the problem right now is that the methane is being released in the melting permafrost much, much faster than anybody had ever imagined could be the case. We release every year the equivalent of 17,000 volcanoes, the equivalent of the one on Hawaii. And so we are in a very dangerous situation in which an irreversible global warming could take place, and in which life on Earth, beginning with the wipeout of mammals, could begin to disappear, perhaps as early, in the opinion of one scientist, as 2025. So we're looking at a worldwide emergency which says we have to find practical ways to get off of fossil fuel so fast that it defies any previous thing that's ever happened.
But what you're describing doesn't sound like it's correlated with fossil fuels. It's just the melting of the permafrost.
Well, that seems to be encouraged by the fossil fuel use. It turns out that global warming is much more serious at the North Pole than it is here in the temperate climate zones. And so 5 years ago, it was discovered that an area the size of France and Germany combined had melted to a depth of 5 meters, that's 15 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something no one expected. And now we're finding that all around the Arctic Ocean, that melting is taking place at a phenomenal rate. And scientists who are studying this, there was a big article in the German magazine Spiegel just last month, are beginning to be very, very worried that everything we can do as human beings to get off of fossil fuels might be the one thing we can do to preserve human life on the planet.
Okay. So, and you've come up with, it looks like a solution that's going to provide us with a new source of energy. So describe that.
Well, what we found in looking around was that when Robert Forward wrote his paper, he suggested ways of tapping zero-point energy, and it caught on with a few scientists, and some of them looked back into history and discovered that in 1926, a German inventor by the name of Hans Kohler, C-O-L-E-R, created and showed a small device which could generate 10 watts of electricity with no apparent input. And he said, this is space energy. And he showed it to numerous university professors, including a rather famous German professor, Schumann, who was the man responsible for identifying what's known as the Schumann resonance of the Earth. And they all agreed that what he had done was genuine. And the following year, a Nobel Prize winner, Werner Heisenberg, came out and said, I think we could use magnetism for energy. And this fellow kept working on it. The Norwegians became interested, and the Norwegian industrial group decided to back him. And the Norwegian legation in Berlin was given a slightly larger version of his unit that I think was generating 70 watts by 1933, and they locked it into a room in the Berlin embassy, the embassy of Norway in Berlin, for 3 months. And at the end of 3 months, they opened the room and found it was still running exactly the way it had when they put it in there. Well, the Norwegians and he had a falling out, but by 1937, he had created a 6,000-watt, a 6-kilowatt version of his work. And that finally came to the attention of the German Navy, and in 1943, Hitler's Admiralty had a top-secret program to utilize what he had done to recharge the batteries of submarines so that the submarines would not have to surface, as all submarines had to do until nuclear-powered submarines began, in order to let the diesel engines that recharge the batteries breathe. And in early 1945, the last year of World War II, the Allies, who apparently got wind of what was going on, bombed the laboratory and destroyed it. However, it happens that Hans Kohler escaped, and after the war ended, he cooperated with British intelligence, and they recreated his machine and did a report. And that report probably originally was more than 200 pages in length, and it was classified. But in 1978, the British government declassified 34 pages of it. And those 34 pages are now very easy to find on the Internet. If you type Hans Kohler, C-O-L-E-R, into Google, up will come this British report, which clearly shows that this was genuine. But, of course, gasoline in 1978 was pretty cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody paid much attention. And the consequence of that is that this has been something that's only been followed up by a relative handful of individuals and companies. And it's now beginning to emerge that we can power everything with this energy. And our company began in 1984. We looked at dozens and dozens and dozens of prototypes that people had built to try to tap this energy. But 5 years ago, we ran into a young inventor who at that time hadn't even turned 30 and who had successfully figured out a way to mechanically tap it. Now, the German work was done without moving parts, and so his next challenge was to find, how can I do this without moving parts? And in December of 2004, he succeeded in doing that and had a very substantial output in excess of the input. And it showed us that this could be commercialized. And in fact, there's an early patent application that's now published on our website, magneticpowerinc.com, magneticpowerinc.com. And if you look at the patent pending on there, you can see how that device was put together in the early prototype. And we've learned a great deal since then. And another patent application on that device will be filed in the near future. And it turns out that there are even simpler devices, which we're now putting together in the laboratory. And it's clear that they'll be able to run everything from cell phones to aircraft. So we're looking at a way of generating electricity as well as heat and everything else we need, mechanical power, without having to burn fuel, without needing nuclear energy. And all of this can be manufactured in most of the world's electronic plants. So there's no reason why it can't be in mass production as early as next year.
My goodness. And now you've talked about zero point, and you've talked about magnetic. Which one?
Well, magnetic seems to be a way of pumping. A magnet seems to be able to pump zero point energy, or perhaps it's more accurately energy for the quantum vacuum, which is this horrendously large, abundant, renewable source of power, very cheaply, and turn it into electricity using circuitry that uses entirely conventional parts and simply puts them together in new ways. That is, because most people in science haven't believed this to be possible, no one's been experimenting with how to do this, except a handful of isolated inventors and just a few small companies all over the world. And one wonderful surprise is that a 37-year-old scientist in Bangladesh, of all places, has now done it successfully. And earlier this year, showed university professors and electrical engineers and mechanical engineers from various institutions in Bangladesh what he had done without moving parts to generate 1,000 watts of electricity. And he did a public demonstration back in February. He did another one last month. And we've put up on our release website, renewableenergyworld.com. If you type in Bangladesh, you'll see a press release of ours about this extraordinary young man who pointed out that he'd spent 17 years developing this and now has large companies from Bangladesh very interested in putting it into mass production. And I might add that we have a half dozen multi-billion-dollar American companies that have signed non-disclosures so they can see the technical aspects of this that are confidential and that are interested in putting these things into mass production in the United States.
So why isn't this making the headlines? Why are we not hearing about this?
Well, I think the primary reason is because every scientist or engineer who hears about this doubts that it can be done because the textbooks but don't indicate that anything like this is possible. And so we've concluded that the big way to circumvent that problem, the major task, is to create toys. And so at our mechanical laboratory, we're developing versions of this that can be demonstration devices for universities and also eventuate into toys that every youngster who wants one can buy an inexpensive toy that sits there and runs without batteries, generating electricity. And the kids will explain to parents how it works. And when the scientist has a youngster come and put one on the desk and say, I know this is impossible, but how do you explain the fact that it's working? Then the scientist has to scratch their head and say, well, my golly, I guess maybe we have to revise a little of our understanding. And you know, the Wright brothers ran into this. They flew, as we all know, in 1903. But the scientific community did not believe it. In fact, they were accused of being scam artists, and they were accused of fraud because scientists had learned that you could not fly anything heavier than air in the way that they claimed to have done. And it wasn't for 5 years until Teddy Roosevelt was president and appointed someone to go up to Columbus, Ohio, and visit these two bicycle mechanics and find out if they'd actually flown a heavier-than-air craft. And they came back and said, by golly, the guy said, yes, they did it. And so Teddy Roosevelt invited him to bring an aircraft down to to Washington, mm-hmm. and they flew it in Washington. And overnight, Scientific American and the Smithsonian and the New York Times, which all had disbelieved that the Wright brothers flew, decided, by golly, I guess you can fly a heavier-than-air craft. The whole history of science is littered with things like this.
Well, even the transistor. I would just read an article just a few days ago that the transistor is in everything now.
That's right, and millions of them are in very ordinary things.
Right.
And yet, when they were first invented at Bell Laboratories, the first one was about the size of a pocket watch, an old-fashioned railway engineer's pocket watch. And a group from Japan visited Bell Laboratories, and as the story goes, when that group was there and said that they thought they were going to make radios with these things, after they left, the Bell Laboratory scientists practically rolled on the floor with laughter. They thought that was the most absurd statement they'd ever heard. Well, of course, today, everything electronic can be made with transistors, and is. And I grew up in electronics. My first job was at Ampex Corporation, which pioneered the field of high-quality tape recording. And when I was an engineer in that company, everything we did was constantly challenged as impossible. The cassette recorder was first invented there, and the video tape recorder, the ability to record on tape initially, and now, of course, in other ways, television. Everybody who knew a lot about electronics was very skeptical that you could do these things until they were done. And then they sort of scratched their heads and said, by gosh, what ingenious things we've now seen come out of laboratories. And often out of the heads of lone inventors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole history of science owes a lot to Nikola Tesla. Tesla was a fellow who grew up in Serbia, came to the United States to work with Edison, and they didn't get along. And he could visualize in his head what became the devices that create alternating current. Everything in the world now runs on AC, or almost everything. We have a lot of DC devices today, small devices particularly. But he invented alternating current. He discovered it. And it was funny because both he and Edison together were awarded a Nobel Prize, but they hated each other so at that point because Edison had been working with direct current, and he hated the thought that people might use alternating current. He used to attack it all the time. And they wouldn't go and accept the Nobel, so it was never received, because they wouldn't appear on the stage together to get the prize. So the history of science is littered with some extraordinary things that have happened because of our blindness. And the interesting thing is that arrogance of scientists, which is really what it is, refusing to believe anything that violates what they learned, is now likely to kill us. And so it's no longer a minor problem. And the interesting thing is that if kids have toys, and the toys are sitting there generating electricity, well, that gets awfully hard to deny. And if you now can take a hybrid automobile, as we hope to do within 12 months, and take a plug-in hybrid can only get 2 kilowatts from a wall outlet, and we think that we can provide 2 kilowatts from a box, maybe slightly larger than a 12-pack of soda. And so now that box, which contains a solid-state device that generates electricity this way, can replace the plug-in of the plug-in hybrid, so it doesn't have to plug in anymore.
So this box will just be sitting in the car and not attached to anything, and it's going to be self-generating.
That's right. And this is, of course, because the energy is every place and simply can be tapped by unusual electronic devices that use parts that are essentially off the shelf. There's very little that has to be done to mass produce this stuff other than to make it sensible by having enough people working in enough laboratories to do it fast enough.
And then I reading on your web, it sounds like you can actually make money from your car sitting generating electricity.
And that's, of course, the really exciting thing. It's been known in the last few years that if and when fuel cells were ever developed, it might be nice to have them able to generate electricity that the local utility can buy. And so there has been a study done by several people in science looking at that possibility. And then along came the plug-in hybrid, and at the University of Delaware, a professor and his colleagues have shown that the average plug-in hybrid could be equipped with a two-way plug. And last April, here in California, Pacific Gas and Electric worked with Google, and they took 5 plug-in hybrids, and 4 of them were conventional and just simply plugged in and recharged. But the 5th one was a two-way hybrid. And when the utility wanted to, it could tap the energy stored in the batteries of the plug-in hybrid and buy that power. And the professor at Delaware who leads that program has pointed out that when that becomes a well-done program countrywide, it may eventually go worldwide, that the average person owning a plug-in hybrid automobile could earn up to $4,000 a year by just selling power from their plug-in hybrid's battery storage without depleting the power they'd still need to drive home from work. And as we looked at this and we realized that these units are going to go up to 150 kilowatts, eventually replacing automobile engines, and that probably can be prototyped within 3 years with enough capital, it can be done in less time because we could do it on a 24/7 basis if we have the funds, and I think we will, to do that. And basically, when that happens, your car becomes a power plant. And instead of just the power from batteries, we're now talking of maybe $15,000 or more a year that the average car owner can earn from a parked car. And the interesting thing is the technology to do that is already available. A company not far from us has visited here because they were developing a system to tap the batteries in electric buses in exactly the way that Google and PG&E cooperated to do it with hybrid automobiles. And they worked with electric buses to the point where they can transmit without any wire connection at all 150,000 watts, 150 kilowatts from a vehicle to the grid when it's parked, when the vehicle's parked. Well, they were working with buses, but every year these units got smaller, and now they're small enough to fit in a car. So when the CEO of the company visited, he said, "Mark, we could have you put one of these in every car that you have coming off assembly lines in Detroit or anywhere else in the world," that the car owner would now have the ability to sell massive amounts of electricity from parked automobiles. And they do this by installing a plate underneath the asphalt of the parking spot, and then in the car, underneath the on the bottom of the car, there's a corresponding plate, and that allows the transmission to take place over a 9-inch gap. And so the car can be parked over the plate, and lo and behold, you're now earning the money to buy your automobile when it's parked at work. And many parking garages in big cities certainly will accept this type of technology. And I can imagine a sign in front of some of them that say, "Park here, we pay more." It gets even better because he also pointed out that when you come home, you could park over a 1-square-foot plate that would transmit up to 10 kilowatts, which would allow the average home to wirelessly take 10 kilowatts from these generators in the car and use it to power the home. Well, just imagine after an earthquake, such as the horrible earthquake that just occurred in China and the earthquakes we've had here in California and elsewhere, or an ice storm or a hurricane or a tornado or any kind of disaster, natural or man-made, if you now have the ability to power your home or your small business from your parked car, just imagine what that does in terms of making life so much easier after a major upset. Here in California, PG&E apologized in January of this year to 2 million of its customers that lost power during one major storm here in Northern California. And some of them lost power for days. So you can see that this is a technology that not only can help us eliminate the need for fossil fuel of every variety, and in fact of all fuel of any variety, including uranium or hydrogen or anything else, we're now looking at something that works 24/7 and that can also power homes. The average home here in California that buys solar cells gets 4 kilowatts worth on the roof, and that would be 4 of these 1-kilowatt boxes, and they'd probably fit under a counter or in a closet or in an attic or in a garage. And you now have all the power that you'd normally get from a solar panel without having to go on the roof from a system that's intrinsically less expensive. These are not units that are going to be high cost.
Any idea what a unit's going to cost for a kilowatt of power?
Well, there's a company interested in manufacturing these early on with us, in which one of the senior engineers has said, Mark, let's aim at $2,000 a kilowatt as the retail price. And in mass production, that should certainly be achievable.
Mm-hmm.
We can see that the early ones will probably go for more than that. In fact, we've been thinking of putting maybe the first 1,000 with numbers on them and auctioning them on eBay. But the basic thing is that in even larger mass production, because these can be made everywhere in the world and will patent every place, well, these are units that eventually will go down and down in price because there's nothing in them that suggests that when they're very, very widely used, electricity can be generated for, at a cost of more than a penny a kilowatt hour. And if you know what your electric bill looks like today and what you get charged per kilowatt hour for electricity you buy, you know that that's a phenomenal number. If we can get anywhere close to that, the world is a very, very different place.
Well, that's a lot to comprehend. How will this affect Detroit and their cars? I mean, are they going to have to really reconfigure their whole engine system, or you talk about that they're going to go into the hybrids, but what about just the regular gasoline? I mean, is the gasoline engine going to be obsolete here? Or?
It is. The interesting thing is that it's very clear that these units can be made small enough to replace engines, and I believe prototypes showing that will be available in no more than 3 years.
Wow.
And they can be either rotary units or solid-state units. We're not sure which will come first, but both can be done. We have one full-time laboratory dealing with units without moving parts, and the other one does units with moving parts. And essentially, what we see is that the first step will be to take the hybrid engine out of a hybrid car. Those are usually less powerful, and they normally just run at constant speed. And so that'll probably be the first engine targeted. And then the engine sizes will just keep increasing until every car is made without the need for an engine. And the interesting thing is Detroit is already gearing up. The world automobile industry is already gearing up. When you look at what General Motors is doing, their design of the car they call the Volt is an evolving design. And that platform, when they first start introducing it in a couple of years, if they meet their target, that platform will be run in such a way that it's very easy for a second generation of that vehicle to have our technology or technology like it. And the same is true behind the scenes at all the big companies. And the interesting thing is once one company starts making cars that don't need fuel, they'll sell every car they can conceivably make. And every company in the world that makes cars will have to shift over because they can't compete with fuel. And essentially that means that Detroit, which we all know is going through a horrendous struggle right now, can lead the world if it's smart and able to flexibly do something new quickly enough. Unfortunately, so far what we see in Detroit is very slow-moving, huge bureaucratic organizations. But, you know, there's a company called Renault, and they've combined with Nissan, and the former guy who headed Renault is now the head of both companies, and Nissan has announced that they're going to start selling an all-electric car here in the United States. They'll start with fleets about 2010, and they'll start with everybody being able to buy an all-electric car by 2012. And their assumption is that you'll have to plug these in to recharge mm-hmm. them. But imagine if the second generation of those cars uses technology like this, ours or someone else's, because the market begins at $6 trillion a year. So there's room for a lot of companies, and we're going to license all over the world, and we already have manufacturers in several countries that are very interested in putting these things into mass production. And what we see is that then you don't need to recharge. And so they're one company that's already looking at the electric car, and you can bet that behind the scenes and very quietly, all of the companies are. When we look at our website, we can monitor companies that go into the website and what they look at. And you'd be surprised at how often automobile companies and Boeing and Lockheed and Grumman, everybody you can imagine in the field of high technology peeks in there to see what's going on. And I'm sure they still don't believe it. But when independent laboratories begin certifying that this works, and by the end of this summer, if all goes well and we have enough working capital to do it, we will have a unit that can be independently validated. There's a laboratory that Harold Puthoff runs down in Austin called EarthTech. EarthTech International is very familiar with this field, and they'll be the first laboratory to evaluate this work. And following their tests, we've been invited to bring it to a very, very widely esteemed national laboratory where our former patent attorney is now a patent attorney. And when he called me last month, he said, "Mark, we want one here."
Mm-hmm.
So sure. as soon as they're done at EarthTech, we'll take that unit to a very distinguished national laboratory not far from where we are and let them just do everything they like to tear it apart and put it back together and see that, in fact, this is absolutely practical, absolutely sensible technology that can be built everywhere.
Can you see any obstacles? Can you see anything that would stop this from happening?
Well, I don't think anything will stop it from happening, but you can see enormous vested interests.
Yeah.
And they're not going to be happy.
Right.
However, the interesting thing is that the brighter people in those companies have children and grandchildren that they're beginning to understand may not survive unless we get rid of fossil fuel much faster than anybody imagines. And so you see companies like Exxon now making lithium batteries for electric cars. And you'll note that behind the scenes, these large oil companies, the bright ones, are really calling themselves energy companies, and they're looking at how could they go forward in a world in which the sources of energy change. And there's no question that the bright people in those companies will end up finding ways to become part of these new technologies, as they always have with changing technology in their own field. But there are going to be people who are blind to the need for this change.
But will they try and stop?
And I'm sure that some of them will. The nice thing is that because this is now coming to the fore in so many places, that is, it's already surfaced in Bangladesh that looks very, very much like it's real from everything we can see, and we have a potential licensee there who visited the inventor and says, "Mark, it seems very much like a parallel to what you're doing in your own program." And these will be like car engines. There'll be hundreds and hundreds of designs that can be patented that will do this because it's a new technology with infinite variations. And we're just beginning to understand how many different kinds of systems can be used to generate power or torque or heat. I mean, just imagine room heaters that sit in the middle of the room and heat without any plug, and those are likely to be in the market within 3 years. And imagine all the people in the world that are cold in the winter months that would like to be able to have systems like that and are now paying through the nose for high-priced oil and coal and everything else.
Mark, will we get our rivers back?
Well, that's interesting because it does indicate that we can gradually move away from hydro. Hydropower is running out of places we can dam to begin with. And when you look at what great dams have done, the damage at the famous project in China is the most glaring example of a huge, huge problem with the environment as a result of damming a river. But, you know, here in California, San Francisco gets its water from the Hetch Hetchy project, and there are people seriously, even before this technology, saying we ought to do away with that. Well, one nice thing is we have these very large puddles that we call oceans, and when you have very inexpensive energy, you can desalinate, and you can desalinate in very, very nice quantities, and then with the same power, you can run pipeline pumps to move fresh water from the ocean everywhere in the world. So that one of the interesting things is when we talk about water shortage, and there is a water shortage.
Yes.
In a lot of places, our south right now, Atlanta is a very worried place. The whole southeast is nervous about the shortages of water. And we already have people talking to us about using these systems to desalinate and run water from the Atlantic to provide water to Atlanta. So we're really looking at something that has a lot of negatives in terms of people not realizing how many positives there are in their own lives. And there'll be ignorant people who will not believe it for a long time and will try to stop it. But, you know, what do you do when something is surfacing in several countries at the same time? I mean, we've seen patents from Japan. We've seen patents from Germany. We've seen patents in Ireland, in Australia, in Canada. There's hardly any advanced place on the planet that people aren't looking at this. Now, they're not all necessarily succeeding. And they may not all have highly competitive price because there are different ways to do it, and some systems will turn out to be much less expensive than others. But it gets very hard to stop something when it's happening everywhere. And it's particularly hard to stop if you think that your kids and your grandkids may not live unless something like this does happen. And I think that everything that's needed to get rid of fossil fuels needs to be done, not just this technology. There are many other technologies, including solar and wind and other things.
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen. Mm-hmm. But the hydrogen, when you think of it being used for cars, unless it's something made on board the car, and there are systems that are doing that to extend gasoline mileage, but thinking of refueling with hydrogen means a multi-billion dollar infrastructure has to be built and installed in service stations, and that takes so long that by the time it happens, there'll be many, many more cars running on these systems, and you don't need that. So that's not likely to ever really take place. That's another of the fantasies. General Motors, by the way, still believes that's going to happen, and their program, as far as we know, involves 150 R&D engineers, research and development, and another 600 production line engineers for a hydrogen system, and they're going to install pumps at gas stations in a few major cities. And just about the time they get all that together, these systems are going to begin surfacing. And the question will be, is it practical to buy fuel of any kind if you don't need it? Well, the oil companies don't like that because they'd like to get into the hydrogen business. And some of them spent a lot of money so far looking at how to do that. But like everything else in business, you know, there were once stagecoach manufacturers and they've gone away. And the whole history of technology is obsoleting things that we don't need anymore and replacing them with things that are simpler. At least in some ways, they're often quite complex in terms of the internal mechanisms, but they are parts of an evolution of learning. We have to turn into a learning civilization if we're to survive. And that's one of the things that really isn't yet widely understood. People are going to have to learn lots of things that they haven't known just to be able to keep up with what's going on and be able to feed the world and have abundance. But the technology to do those things is happening. And a lot of it is not the work that we're doing. It's work by other people. And one of the interesting things is one possibility is working towards the average person eventually deriving half of their income from diversified investments and therefore having it come from many companies through the mailbox. Now, after the debacle we've had in the housing market and the corresponding drop in stocks, both this time and also with the dot-com crash, a lot of people are understandably going to say, well, my gosh, can we protect against such crazy things? And, of course, you may not be able to do that. But if we make a goal, reducing the nominal work week, which is presently 40 hours, to a nominal work week of 20 hours, in which the other half of the income comes from the mailbox in diversified investments, including perhaps dividends from institutions that are not as risky as the high-tech companies and stock market investments. But the interesting thing, if you can do that, is you can think as a thought process of a two-day week, of two 10-hour days, and 5 days of the week in which the average person has the income and the time to do what they choose to do with their own lives. Now, that would be the first really free, free society in all of human history. And there's nothing now that says we can't do that. And it's interesting because this is the only country that can lead the way to do that. And so now that we've come through such a horrendous period of great difficulty and huge problems, it would be interesting to see if we can turn the planet into the university that it really is. Because today, the things that people really have to learn are really not constrained in the four walls of classrooms. The planet is an open university. It's a university without walls. And everything that we need to know is now available. You can buy access very cheaply with a computer to just about any kind of information you want. And with the laptop they're making for every child that will eventually be a $100 investment, kids everywhere are learning how to use this resource. So we're at a point where all the things we've taken for granted may change, and if we're wise enough to use a lot of humor and a lot of sense in the way we change these things, we may find that instead of a very bleak period, we're about to open the most exciting era in human history.
Very exciting. Where are you getting your financing? How is that working out?
Well, it so far has all come from private individuals, and we have done a little bit of work for the federal government. We completed 4 contracts for the government. We have a subsidiary developing what are called superconductors. These, we call them ultraconductors because they're made of plastic. They're polymers. And the average scientist in superconductivity can't believe that you can make plastic into a superconductor. So to avoid arguing with physicists, we call them ultraconductors. But they do everything a superconductor does, and they do it at room temperature. And we've completed 4 contracts with the United States government on that work. And most of our money came in for that work because that was easily proven. That was tested independently for the Air Force by a different company, and it also has been reproduced independently by other companies here in the United States with our cooperation and at laboratories and universities in other countries. And so there were investors in the early days who said, well, you know, I believe that your superconductors or ultraconductors are real, but I don't want any part of this crazy work you're doing in energy because I can't believe that could ever work. And so at the insistence of some of our larger investors, we set up a separate corporation, which is a subsidiary of Magnetic Power, called Room Temperature Superconductors Incorporated. And that company was able to raise money very easily from angel investors up until the dot-com crash.
What do you mean by angel investors?
Well, angel investments started in the theater in Broadway. People who put up money for shows were called angels. And as high tech has evolved, angels are the people who put up most of the money for new technology in this country, and now it's spreading throughout the world. And when you look at any new high tech company, you find that most of the money starts out with friends and families, and then it comes from angels. And they're often people who've built successful companies of their own and then want to help other companies to grow. And so those angels have supported most of our work to this point. But after the dot-com crash, most of the people who had invested in the stock market, which our investors had done, were hurting very badly, and that investment just started to dry up. And for a while, we just thought, boy, we're going to have to shut this game down. And it has been nip and tuck ever since, because what's happened is that the energy technology has finally started attracting small amounts of money in the same way from private individuals. And now we're almost at the point, the very large funding that this really needs. We have several sources talking to us very seriously. But we still have to bridge to that. We don't yet have that money in the bank. And as anybody who's ever put a business together knows, until it's in the bank, it isn't real.
Right, right. So let's open up the question. Is it, how can somebody get involved with this financially?
We aren't allowed to talk about how they can do that since we're not a public company,
okay,
but a private one. However, if people will send us an email at magneticpower@gmail.com, that's magneticpower@gmail.com, or if they fill out the contact information on the website at magneticpowerinc.com, magneticpowerinc, all one word, .com, either of those, and tell us they would like such information, we'll be glad to provide it.
Well, so the soonest that we're going to really see or hear anything about this, probably the end of the summer, you're hoping for some activity, and then when will the toys come out?
Well, the toys probably won't really hit the market until next year, and we hope by next Christmas. Every kid who wants one will be able to buy a toy. And it's interesting because, you know, a very famous scientist died not long ago. Clark was his name. And he was the guy who was responsible for the film 2001 and was the first one to suggest geosynchronous orbit was possible. And as you know, we now have satellites in geosynchronous mm-hmm. orbit, and that's where so much of what we hear on television or see on television bounces off these satellites. And he died just a few weeks ago. And it's interesting because in 1991, someone asked him what his predictions were about technology for the future. And he said, well, in 2009, I think we will find that quantum space energy appears and is distributed, it's decentralized, and it powers things and individual homes, and the power lines begin to disappear. And we think he was right on target.
Wow.
2009 is probably precisely when the world will begin to experience these changes. And probably within 5 years, automobiles that are mass-produced will be coming off assembly lines that never need any fuel whatsoever.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, 5 or 6 minutes left. Anything else that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I think a few of the interesting things with this that are fun are the fact that you can look at aircraft that can fly this way, and that has wonderful overtones because, as you know, the most dangerous part of flying is the fuel load. And by the way, 50,000 people a year have serious burns from automobile accidents in the United States. Because gasoline, of course, is a highly flammable fuel. And so what we're looking at is much safer flight. And a lot of the space that's now taken up by fuel can be used to carry more people. And a lot of the noise that airplanes now make might be much quieter because these can be designed with electric motors that make very little noise.
Wow. Wow. And how about space travel?
And the same is true of space travel. Everything we thought we had to do with rocketry, we're learning can be done with electromagnetics. And the game is likely to show that we've been riding Roman candles into space when we can much more elegantly move into space with systems that don't use fuel. And so that allows us to consider doing very large satellites that can accommodate thousands of people who might want to live on satellites. It allows us to think of exploring the near-term solar system, that is, the near-space solar system, Mars and our moon, in much greater detail and much more inexpensively and simply than is now the case. And we think that you're likely to see that where people are now talking of being able to go into space for fun and for, you know, just resorts in space, that these will be reachable by electromagnetic systems that will propel craft that don't have to have rocketry, and rocketry is going to always be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's rather nice not to ride a Roman candle if you're going into space. And so that, of course, is going to happen.
Do you see anything with personal health? How any relationship with your technology and making people healthier?
Well, I think that a great part of what we've learned affects health very negatively is the process of burning fuel.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we know that cancer is something that is environmentally often caused, and that the exhaust of automobiles is not something particularly healthy. A few decades ago, we learned that the brakes of automobiles were releasing asbestos, which in Lower Manhattan was so serious that just about everybody who worked there had serious asbestos in their lungs. Now you don't see asbestos in brakes anymore. And so we know that there are going to be many, many things, many inventions we hardly suspect. Ultraconductors can also do some wonderful things that will allow everything to operate in ways that are far more efficient, using far less energy, and with far less danger. And the less that we have to do to make things, the safer the manufacturing processes become. The less junk we're pouring into the air and into the water, and that's a major problem here on Earth.
Any predictions with the nanotechnology and in providing energy for that source?
Well, the polymers, the ultraconductors, are nanotechnology, and we have yet another ultraconductor coming into the program, which is also nanotechnology. And we know that the nanotechnology will be immensely helped by what we're learning, but it also will contribute enormously. Imagine all the copper wire, which is now at an all-time high in price,
mm-hmm.
being replaced by plastic wire that carries power far more effectively, that a wire 1/50th the diameter of a human hair will always carry 50 amperes. That normally takes about a quarter inch of copper
wow.
in diameter. So we're looking at remarkable changes, all of which are hard to believe until you see them, and they have the potential to provide us with tools to attack these serious problems in ways that allow for a spiritual change, something which allows people to have hope again and to begin to see that all the things we've wanted to see happen on this planet that seem so difficult to achieve might in fact be achievable, and many of them might begin to be obvious in that sense within our own lifetimes.
I was just thinking before you said that you must go to sleep every night with a smile on your face.
I do.
You must.
It's great fun.
Oh, my goodness, this is so exciting. It's just, again, I'm just surprised that we're not hearing anything about it, but I suspect once the door opens that's all we're going to hear about.
Well, and there's still lots of negativity because everyone trained in science is taught that you can't do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's the superconductors, which scientists still don't believe even though they've been out there and we've already shown them in several labs.
Okay, Mark, we just have a few seconds, so one more time with a web page.
Magnetic Power Inc., magneticpowerinc.com, will get you to the web page,
and
that will get
there.
You everywhere
else. There's quite a few articles there, and what an exciting interview, and thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome, and the article called Bridgewalk on the articles page may be of special interest. That's about the Brooklyn Project.
Great. Very good. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Yep. Good
night. Bye-bye.